here. I can feel it.
You search for the scent of your prey, and then you hunt them down. That's the only thing you're committed to.
It keeps me sharp, on the edge, where I gotta be.
You want to be making moves on the street? Allow nothing to be in your life that you cannot walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you spot the heat around the corner.
No, my life's a disaster zone because I spend all my time chasing guys like you around the block.
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best, trying to stop guys like me.
You've been walking through our life dead.
All I am is what I'm going after.
To another episode of the Holmes Movies Podcast. My name is Anders Holmes, and I'm joined by my brother Adam, who is not over Skype. He is here in Denmark, and he is a little bit ill.
Yes, I've been in... I was in London before I came to Denmark, and went out a lot to the pub, and it was wet, and I definitely had many beers, and then came to Denmark. It's also been damp here. I've also had many...
It's been windy as fuck.
Yes, many things have entered my system, and I've been on two aeroplanes, and so law of averages dictates that I now have a cold. So I apologize, but it is lovely to be here all the same.
Yeah, we've had a nice few days down with our mum and friends and everything.
Yeah. It was very lovely.
Yes.
So why am I here? What are we doing?
We're doing a podcast.
Yes, no, I know that. Which, what are we talking about?
So it's not Scary Movie Month anymore, so we're not talking about horror films or anything like that.
Too bad. That was fun.
That was a good fun. I enjoyed talking about Frankenstein, Night of the Hunter, and American Werewolf in London, which you can listen to on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud, and all the other places that we had the podcast on.
Other podcast platforms are available.
Yes.
One assumes. I don't really know.
And the film that we're going to talk about today, we were... debating about, I don't know, not really debating, but we had a hard time trying to figure out like what next film to talk about.
Yeah, we discussed potentially talking about The Usual Suspects. We've also talked about various other films, a lot of 90s films. Like I remember we talked about doing The Hunt for Red October at one point. And I think we realized that we'd never really dealt with Michael Mann in any big way.
No, we haven't actually. Maybe we've brought him up in conversations, but we've never really talked about one of his films that he's done.
Right. So,
So the film that we've decided to talk about is his film Heat, which originally he did a film, I think it was a TV movie called LA Takedown, which essentially he is...
Sounds like a Grand Theft Auto game.
Yeah, it does. I think Heat was like a remake. I think someone did like a comparison of like both versions of on YouTube and like seeing, because it's basically the same story and the same script. I think it was like a TV show idea or something, and then it just didn't work out and he did it as a TV movie, but then he went back and remade it as a near 3-hour film.
Yeah.
Heat.
What do you got?
You got a big ass.
So yeah, for those of you who may have heard of Heat, or haven't heard of Heat, actually. Heat, it was the film that put... It wasn't the first film that they were in, but it was the first film that Robert De Niro and Al Pacino shared a scene together, because they both were in Godfather Part 2, but they didn't share a scene together in that
film. I think
film.
This is a fact that literally everyone knows.
Yeah.
It's like, if you know one thing, it's like, you know, day is night... Sorry, what the fuck am I talking about? Oh, God, my cold has gone to bed. Day is light and night is dark. And Robert Pacino... Robert Pacino... Fucking hell!
in an alternative universe. Oh, he's called
Robert Pacino and Al De Niro. Al De Niro sounds quite good, actually. Yeah, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro had never been in a scene together. And this is what everyone talks about. And everyone talks about how amazing it is. But it's actually the least interesting thing about this film in some ways. You know, I think there's a temptation to think that, oh, well, this is just an excuse to have De Niro and Pacino playing together. And you sort of build the film around that. But it really is, it is a lot more than that. I mean, if you want a film that's just an excuse to put Pacino and De Niro together, you need to watch that, what was it called? The terrible cop thing.
Oh, Righteous Kill.
Righteous Kill, yeah, yeah.
Is a... not a good film. It is very bad.
So that's not I feel like that's the banner headline with this film, but there's a lot more happening here.
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, for a very simple story about, you know, De Niro plays a professional bank robber or criminal basically, and Al Pacino plays
thief.
This
I think that's he's a thief. That's the term.
Yeah,
the which term of art
coincidentally was Michael Mann's first film, called Thief with James Caan. And then he did Manhunter after that. Have you seen Manhunter?
Michael Manhunter. No, I haven't, but I've heard very many good things about it.
Yeah, a lot of people seem to say it's like it's better than Red Dragon.
Some people say it's better than Silence of the Lambs, which I find very hard to believe because Silence of the Lambs is perfect.
I need to watch that all the way through. But anyway, yeah, so like Al Pacino plays Vincent Hanna, who's an LAPD Robert E. Homicide.
That'd be a great name.
Yeah. So, yeah, the opening of the film, which I have to say starts off the film very strongly in some ways, because it's Robert De Niro and Val Kilmer, Tom Sizemore, and who is the other?
Tom Sizemore. This is like peak Sizemore, this period.
Yeah.
There are so many great 90s character actors in this film, and Sizemore is one of many. Yeah, the opening is great because you've got this film that basically it's in the great tradition of like LA set crime epics. So whether that's you know, going back to the days of film noir and The Big Sleep and all that, to all the way up to like Nightcrawler, and it really sort of bathes in the city, and you see all these guys getting up to their shifty dealings.
And all the sort of preparations that they do before the bank robbery and everything else that they do.
And then they knock over the... Well, it's not a bank, is it? They knock over an armored car. Yeah.
That sort of starts off the whole movie. And it's... One of the things I will say about Michael Mann is that he's really good at directing action. And I think he's good at directing realistic action in regards to how guns should sound and how people should, you know, work with firearms on sets. Because I feel like... I don't know, I was watching Joe Rogan's podcast, a video, he puts like all the video clips on YouTube, and he was talking with a, I think it was a Navy SEAL guy, and he has, like the Navy SEAL guy has problems with how actors are with guns on film, because it's like, what are they doing? Because it's like, it's completely inaccurate.
Yeah. I love the idea. So, you need to hold that like a goddamn soldier! And just Matt Damon be like, sorry!
But yeah, no, it's just the way the bullets sound and everything about it.
It's very visceral, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very visceral.
The gunfire in this is very loud. It's very, you know, when people get shot, it really makes a big, like, you know, axe hitting a watermelon kind of sound. And
it's not
blood splattered, but it's definitely violence that packs a punch. In very much someone else who's in that tradition, not to compare them at all, because, you know, Michael Mann is in a different slightly lower league, but Fritz Lang, you know, the way he directed violence had that similar viscerality, you know, and that's probably the first time that someone has compared Fritz Lang to Michael. Well, actually, who knows? On the internet, anything goes. That's quite a scene, that first robbery.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal as well. I feel Christopher Nolan watched that first scene and use that for the inspiration for the bank robbery scene in the opening of The Dark Knight, because it has that same sort of vibe, because it has like one guy who they pick up and then it all goes wrong and everything like that.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. There's definitely, I think there's plenty of Michael Mann in the Christopher Nolan Batman movies for sure. I think that, as I was saying, like one of the things this film just gets perfectly and kind of helps to redefine for the modern era is the sense of the crew coming together to do a job and then the job itself. And then, you know, but then this you get, you know, the guy gets killed on during the robbery. They pretty much execute someone.
The guys pretty quickly.
Because they have that one psycho who they've just started working with.
Yeah, I was trying to find out with the guy. It's, yeah, Wayne Grow, who's played by Kevin Cage.
Kevin Cage.
It's Gage. Like,
no, it's Kevin Gage.
Kevin Gage.
Yeah, he's pretty psychotic, and then they afterwards try and bump him off, and he escapes. And
they try to get rid of him because they realize that he's a liability, and you know he's a psychopath basically. Like,
yeah,
which they show later on, he kills like a woman out of nowhere.
Yep, and he causes a lot of other damage during this incredibly long film. But then we get to meet Pacino, who's this wired kind of. Smartly dressed a bit like a used car salesman, kind of.
Yeah, he's a streetwise guy. He knows criminals. He's got a bunch of he's got like a team. He's got Wes Studi, who's like his partner.
Another great 90s character actor.
Yeah. And Ted Levine.
Ted Levine.
Well.
Yep.
Oh wait, she's a big old fat person.
This time I'm on the other side of the law.
Of course you can use my phone.
No, we're not gonna do the whole thing. Come on.
Yeah, okay.
Lean it in.
So
put a lotion in the basket. Put a lotion in the basket.
Rubs the lotion on itself or else it gets the hose again.
We can't do this every time.
He had a hard time trying to get roles after that.
Dougie's going to have a hard time listening to this podcast the way we're going.
Well, they're investigating it, and also the thing about Al Pacino is like there's another film going on at the same time. You have seasoned criminal Robert De Niro planning a job and then him meeting a girl that he meets in a coffee shop or something like that. And then they form a relationship and then they're sort of setting up the next job. And then there's this whole thing with William Fichtner. And then on the
side. Yeah. Okay, so I think we're getting into one of the problems with Heat, which is that there are about 80,000 things happening.
Yeah.
And about two of them are relevant. Like, there are so many plots going on. There is so much in this three-hour bouillabaisse of a film that, you know, it's very hard to keep track of everything. It is, you know, I think this is the central flaw. The film is really very, very long and very, very packed full of, you know, it casts. Everyone is bloody well in it. And so they have this, you know, it's this sort of like Longest Days style ensemble all working through this, working through all their problems. You know, you've got Pacino and his partner having marital issues, and Natalie Portman is there. It's his stepdaughter and her daughter, and that was all happening. They got Robert De Niro like making big cutesy doe eyes at this woman who he takes back to his improbably large seaside mansion, which he doesn't have any fucking furniture in, which is not... what's that? Like, he's very, who lies low like that?
He's very minimalist. And then you have Val Kilmer as well.
You got Val Kilmer. He's got he's gambling or something, isn't he?
Yeah, and then he's also got girl relationship problems with Ashley Judd.
Judd, hello, welcome to the party. And you got Hank Azaria, who's
Mo.
Yeah, Mo. And
Danny Trejo.
Yeah, Danny Trejo. Yeah, so very, very, very many things happening. And, but you know, you've got the central idea, which is guys pull off robbery...
Mm-hmm.
Go slightly wrong, then they plan the next one. The next one is also destined to be not, you know, a brilliant success.
Yeah, and then out of nowhere, while they're like, there's like a moment where they're watching them, and then they realize, oh wait, the tables are turned. Now they're watching those, like the cops. Are watching the robbers, and then the robbers.
They are watching them. That's a really good, well done, well explained. No, you're right. There's that brilliant scene where they're trying to work out why De Niro and his bunch were in a particular place. It's like a sort of
quarry.
Yeah, no, it's I thought it was like a dock, like with.
It looks like it's like a work, like a construction site kind of place.
It's, I thought it's like a cargo loading, like a port. Not the. But the other thing is like, where the hell are the security guards on the gate on this place?
No idea.
This is a very it's interesting about this film because like a lot of the time the city feels very empty, which is, you know, in a grand Hollywood tradition of you know, city streets where you have something extraordinary happening and a guy is just reading his newspaper. But yeah, so then they turn the tables. It's one of those set pieces, and it really feels like it really feels like a certain kind of, like, when I watched that scene as a teenager, I was like, that's so cool, how awesome. It's like, and then I watched it as a adult and I'm like, well, okay, you know what they look like, they know what you look like.
Yeah.
Good. And then this you know, this whole weird, like, love story pussyfooting around each other thing between Pacino and De Niro happens, and it culminates in that scene where they go for a coffee together because
it's really weird. Pacino is tailing De Niro, like, there's like a helicopter, and then he's on the highway, yeah, and then he like stops him, like he's like, you know, stopping a guy from speeding or something, and he's like, hey, how you doing, you want to go for a coffee?
Yeah.
And then they sit in a coffee house very monotone and just stoic with one another, and everyone just thinks that scene is,
yeah, everyone has a big old like collective wank over that scene, and it's interesting idea, sure, but, and this whole idea of the cat and mouse game between the hunter and the hunted, and yeah, of course you can't just put him in prison because you haven't actually caught him doing anything yet, but
yeah, he hasn't done anything, there's that scene when they're watching them, and then they're in like a tanker or something, and then one cop like rests up against something, and then,
oh yeah, he makes a noise,
and then the thieves
hear them, and they abandon the
whole thing, and then
could have saved a lot of lives. That bloke, can you imagine what would have happened when Al Pacino got hold of him? Like, just, oh my god, like, they never show us that scene, but the amount of shouting, and that's the other thing. It's like, I mean, we're talking about, I mean, the, let's go back to the performances, because there's a lot there too, yeah. But yeah, that is a funny thing. This, it is an interesting idea, and that scene does feel a little bit gratuitous in hindsight, as does in fact much of the film.
Yeah.
As nice as it is as an idea, it does also go on a little bit too long, which is not a bad metaphor.
Well, I mean, the whole thing. Movie. I mean, it details their whole lives and stuff, and you know, this whole thing about De Niro's code that he lives by, and which he breaks by the end of the movie when, you know, De Niro, when he's chased into the airport.
Oh yeah.
And you know, it's like, you know, they look at themselves as like a couple of regular fellas and things like that, and they both live by their ways, and you know, De Niro's like, you know, I do what I do, I take down scores, and then you take down guys like me and stuff. So,
but it's interesting, yeah, because this whole code thing, it's all very macho. It's also a little bit of this,
yeah,
adolescent reading of like the Shinto samurai, whatever you want to call it, you know, it smacks a little bit of the Ronin thing, which we talked about on this podcast. We talked about Ronin and how,
which is a great,
it's a great action movie, nothing, you know, absolutely nothing wrong with it as an action film, but it does slightly overplay the whole samurai thing.
Yeah.
But you know,
careful.
Just whacked my microphone. Is it still recording?
Yeah.
Okay, still good. It does run into that issue of like, do we need to spend all this time like looking at each other and talking about our code of morality and our, like, you know, way of life? And it's like, well, actually, like, De Niro seems to spend a lot of time just sort of making shit up as he goes along. Like, he gets into a relationship with someone who he does not know, and he you know, like, just has this enormous house, as we've mentioned, with no furniture in it, but also on the beach in fucking Southern California. Like, who has that?
Yeah, it does. I mean, from what I remember, it was hard to really connect with, even with the bad guys. There was hard to like have any emotional connection with any of the characters a little bit.
If you can emotionally connect, I think, to Al Pacino's character, because he's a driven man, he's probably a bit of a cunt. He's like a raging torrent of stuff. But it's all relatable. Like, he's desperately trying to put together a marriage. He's obsessed with capturing the bad guys. And he, you see how much he cares when he comforts that
the mother of the murderer.
Yeah. He spends a lot of time shouting. I can relate to that. And you know, he has a sort of, he is driven in a way that's quite plausible. De Niro, on the other hand, is either boring a lot of the time in this film, just like, you know what, I rob stuff, you know.
So you never want it, and then he's like, you never wanted a regular type life. What the fuck is that? Barbecues and ball games?
Right, like, he does seem quite sort of blank. Like, he doesn't seem to have a great passion beyond
robbing people.
Right, exactly. And
yeah, there's no, I think, you know, a lot of these like crime films and stuff, like they're doing something that, you know, if I mean, looking at like something like Point Break, there's a reason why those guys are robbing all those banks. It's not for the money, it's for the rush, and also it's their whole like sticking it to the man and, you know, fuck the establishment kind of thing. Or like, you know, some people, you know, in other films they rob banks to like pay off a debt or something like that. Or like in Ocean's 11, you know, he's, you know, George Clooney's wanting to get his wife back, sort of thing.
Yeah.
With this, it's just like, you know, every time when there's that scene, the first time you see him in his very minimalist apartment by the coast, he's looking...
It's not an apartment, it's a full-on house.
It's a full-on
it's
house.
It's like one of the houses from you know, the... It's like the classic...
Hollywood house.
The house that, like, it's like Jackie Treehorn's house, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And he's, you know, and there's a, you know, he's looking out of the water and stuff, but like, why is he looking out there? Is it just so that Michael Mann can just put more blue into his movie?
Yeah, and it's really just to, because they decide, right, in this film, Pacino is going to be shouty.
De Niro's going to be quiet.
And De Niro's going to be broody. And this is the thing, because, you know, we've got halfway through talking about the plot, and this is, there's this midsection of this movie that just sags. It's like a big bag. Like, the beginning and the end are quite taut, I'd say, especially the beginning.
Yeah.
And then there's this huge, like, flabby belly of the middle that really needs to do some sit-ups and trim some fat. But then we have the robbery scene. But before we get to that, I want to agree with you. Like, Robert De Niro's character in this is so dull, because like, he doesn't seem to have any real motivations, and he doesn't do anything beyond preparing for the job. Whereas Pacino, when he's not at work, he's trying to fix
his marriage.
The misery that he's caused by not being at work.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so then they do the bank robbery, and that is...
That's a pretty...
And then you get the president from 24. What's
Dennis
his name?
Haysbert.
Dennis Haysbert is there.
Who you forget is in the film for like... He's in like two scenes throughout the whole film, and then he shows up as like... He's like a criminal who's, you know, on parole, and he's given this job at a diner, and he's, you know, he gets shit from his boss, and he doesn't like it, and he's in a relationship with a girl, and I think, you know, that whole thing about criminals trying to rehabilitate and get themselves back into society, I think he's struggling a bit with that. But then he goes back when, you know, coincidentally, De Niro, they know the guy, and they're sitting in the same coffee shop that he works at, and then they end up tagging him along, and then he, spoiler alert,
yeah, probably gets killed.
He dies.
I mean, so, again, that's just one of the myriad tiny plots in this huge...
But it just shows you that he was trying to do, Michael Mann was trying to do a TV show, but he couldn't do it, so he ended up doing a 3-hour movie.
Right, and in some ways you can say it's a pretty much a testament to Michael Mann that he managed to cram as much in as he does, because the way we've already talked about like 8 different plot lines and you know they are all in the film. It's just that it starts to get very exhausting.
It doesn't feel like. Yeah, even everything leading up to the bank robbery, it's all like, there's the build-up is kind of, it's gotten saggy. It's not as like...
Yeah, and it's...
Interesting, and you're not losing interest in what exactly is happening.
And you're sort of, quote-unquote, getting to know people, but you're not really getting to know anyone, except...
Pacino.
Pacino and to some extent, you know, De Niro's character, because he's got his love story, and that's the way he expresses himself, and Pacino's just going around shouting at everything that moves. And
also... Val Kilmer as well, because you know he's on the poster as well. He's almost treated like the third lead of the movie in some ways.
Oh yeah, he totally is. Like so the bank robbery is a really great scene. There's that incredible shootout,
which I think after the movie came out, there was a North Hollywood, they called it the North Hollywood shootout. There were two guys who watched Heat and decided to get a bunch of guns and just rob stuff, and then they got into a huge shootout. Yeah,
fucking hell.
Yeah, it happened a few years after that. It was televised and shit like that.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, a very good argument for an immediate assault weapons ban. And I think actually that shooting, it might not have been the North Hollywood shootout, but it could have been the there was some different, it was, and it was in the 90s as well, because it did lead to a ban on assault weapons, which obviously then expired under George Bush and is now no longer in place, much to everyone's disquiet who cares about not being shot in public places. But it's a hell of a, it's a big old action set piece, isn't it? And it's all...
It's all without music, and it's all on location in the downtown LA, and
it's all on foot. Like, there isn't a big stupid car chase, and there isn't. They just do this really tense, tight.
Yeah, they're all like, you know, Pacino and Robert De Niro. I don't know how old they were at the time, but they're, you know, running and doing all this kind of crazy stuff, and it's like pretty full on.
Oh yeah, and there's that famous thing about Val Kilmer changing his clip or reloading the gun while on the run. Yeah. Which apparently was used in some training video or something at West Point, or at least it has been cited as like a really good example of how to perform that particular action.
Exactly.
And then, we lose a couple of guys. I think the police lose one guy.
Ted Levine.
Ted Levine gets it, and
Tom Sizemore gets it.
And Tom Sizemore, Pacino does for him, and so you know, two characters in this enormous film.
But then it drags on even more, because then it's all about Robert De Niro, you know, trying to tie up some loose ends and go on the run, because you know Danny Trejo gets killed by Wayne Grove or someone in connected with him, and then William Fichtner, who's like this boss guy, because it was like a whole thing with like William Fichtner where he decided to screw them over, and then Wayne Grove tells him about this bank job, and then he rats them out, and then De Niro.
Yeah, it's all very complicated, because William Fichtner's some kind of sleazy businessman type.
Yeah.
And
proper William Fichtner role.
And he's got that bodyguard who's played by the guy from Black Flag.
Yeah, Henry Rollins.
Yeah. Which is also, again,
random.
And that adds another layer, and Wayne Grove is still kicking about, and so the whole film becomes about Robert De Niro's fixation with killing off this guy who looks like Charles Manson, and
a bit more muscly,
a sort of muscly, taller version of Charles Manson, which he eventually does, but it doesn't. It
look
doesn't
at me,
and doesn't end well. Yeah. And then you have the shootout on the runway, which is or in the airport where. You've got interplay of lights and shadow, and
it reminded me a little bit of Bullet, when Steve McQueen chases the bad guy off the plane and then into the, you know, in the runways and stuff in that film.
Yeah, and I mean the sort of I get the concept behind me. It's definitely a fun idea with, as I say, the lights and shadow and stuff. But I do not. It's a weird kind of. The film sort of fizzles out, as there's this very frenetic build up to that where, you know, De Niro's running around and Pacino's chasing him. He's like two steps behind him, but he's gonna get there. And then he has to do that heartbreaking thing where he walks away from this woman who he's just met,
Amy Brenneman.
Yeah, right.
I was just looking on the IMDb page. Amy Brenneman, who played Edie, disliked the script and didn't want to be in the movie, saying it was too filled with blood. With no morality. Michael Mann told her that with that mindset, she would be perfect for the role of Edie.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and also, you'd probably made all right dough on this.
Yeah, I think she did. Yeah.
I feel like the film kind of just sort of comes to this end, which I think is supposed to feel kind of grand and meaningful, but ends up just feeling a bit like, well, what have we learned? Like, a bunch of people have died.
Yeah, because he sits with him and holds his hand while he's dying and stuff. Like, but there's no any kind of relationship that they've been built up. It's not like, it's not Luke and his father or anything like that. It's just a cop and a guy he's chasing. There's no relationship between those characters.
And the explanation for why he has to, like, why De Niro feels the need to go down shooting, like can't go to, I mean, he seems to already have been to prison once. I mean, now of course he's killed a bunch of people, and so that's, but like, it's not as well explained. Like, I feel like in another film where that sort of ending happens is you know, the taking of Pelham 123, where Robert Shaw's character kills himself at the end of the film because the job's been a failure, but you've There's something in Robert Shaw's performance throughout the movie that tells you that he cannot go to prison. He will either succeed or he will die. But it on his terms. And that you totally believe that. You totally believe the performance. I don't get the same sense from De Niro in this film. And there's just something weird about the fact that he's just been like in the deadly gunfight with Pacino. Then he gets shot. And then he just sort of lies there meekly dying rather than like, you know, he doesn't do the dark, the Black Knight from the you know, tis but a scratch, the Three Kings.
Yeah, exactly.
Three Kings, the Holy Grail. You know, it's all very odd. So I don't know. And then it just leaves all this sort of mess of a crime landscape. And it feels just like you've had a bit too much, like, you know, when you've had a bit too much to eat.
Yeah.
It feels like that. You feel full and you feel a bit uncomfortable, you feel a bit sick. Even though along the way, very much there was very much to like. It's an interesting thing because I do basically like Heat. I rewatch it every once in a while because it is a well-made epic movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
you scratch the surface a little and you encounter a lot of problems.
Yeah, when you look at it from a different perspective. I think the first time you watch it, it's like, oh, De Niro and Al Pacino in a movie together. And then when you watch it, it's just, see a few issues here.
In this film, right, great.
Yeah.
I mean, the Stick to Godfather Part 2, if you really want to see it.
And if you really like it, Righteous Kill.
Well, no. I suppose, you know, we're talking around the time that The Irishman has come out, which is supposed to be excellent. So we'll see.
Yeah, that's been getting a lot of positive buzz. And I'm seeing it next week in the cinema, and I'm really looking forward to it. And from what I've heard, for a 3-hour movie, it flies by really quickly.
Yeah, not something you can say about Michael Mann's.
You can really feel its length.
Yeah, and it really weighs on you. And there's, as I say, even talking about it now, just like reliving the film, because it's been a couple of years since I watched it.
Yeah.
But it just, there's just so many scenes.
It does feel like it feels like a I don't know, maybe it feels like a lot of episodes of a TV show, and it's like, and it's whole season run, like the beginning of season one, and then the armored car robbery, and then whatever season it went on for. The bit of scene at the airport. And it feels like the greatest hits of all the episodes that played up and during that season
it feels a little bit like a 10 episode crime drama, you know, like The Bridge or The Killing, Scandinavian crime dramas where there's all these different plots. It definitely feels like it would do better as
something like
True Detective.
Yeah, True Detective,
So, I think we've been a bit hard on it at the same time. Like, there are a lot of good things to enjoy. I love some of the Pacino. I mean, it's so easy to sort of mock Pacino,
but this was like
this performance, you know, because it's so in that like swaggering, shouting, like eyes popping out of his head.
It's like, but who? What are you, a fucking owl?
Yeah. And I feel like this and Scent of a Woman really are those. The peak kind of shouty Al Pacino.
Well, I mean, the 90s was just filled with Al Pacino just chewing the scenery in that thing. I read like a review for The Irishman, like him and Joe Pesci, they're like competing for scene chewing in that film.
Irishman. God, really?
Yeah, and which I'm excited to watch. But like, there was another film that came out in the 90s about a couple of years afterwards, The Devil's Advocate, with Keanu Reeves playing a deep South lawyer who's brought to New York to, you know, be a part of this prestigious law firm. And as it's spoiled in the title, you know, Al Pacino's the devil. And he just goes on these really long monologues where he's talking about God and him and his relationship with God and stuff like that. And he just like just chewing the scenery and just shouting and just being like, he's an absentee landlord.
Oh my God. We've come a long way from Dog Day Afternoon.
Annika!
Yeah, well, okay. So he does some shouting at that as well. But you know what I mean? Like, it feels like
he does in his first movie, Panic in Needle Park. Yo! I was gonna marry you.
Okay, so maybe it is just consistent.
Yeah,
like, there's, you know, because it's like, you know, the old Rob Brydon bit about like, what I want, you know, what's most important for me. And then he goes back to her, she had a great ass.
Apparently he improvised that bit.
Oh my God.
And like Hank Azaria's reaction is pretty genuine.
What can you say?
What do you got?
It's enjoyable. That's the thing.
Yeah.
No matter how silly and overblown it is, in which it, you know, undoubtedly is the case, like there's something spectacular and bombastic about Pacino that feels, you know, you just can't help but smile.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you know what he's doing, and you know how, it's like, he's like the sort of Jose Mourinho of actors in that way. It's like, you know, well, come on, like, you know, we all know what's going on, but you can't kind of, you're sort of fascinated at the same time. And I'm not implying that, like, there's any, he has any character defects, unlike Jose Mourinho, of course. You know, it is just, you find yourself watching it and enjoying his over-the-topness. And that's why I get frustrated more with De Niro's character, who's left to kind of wither on the vine with this rather dull love story.
Yeah, he's not given that much to do in the movie a little bit.
So basically, yeah, I say it's one of those big fat 3 out of 5, you know, definite points for visuals, definite points for like the chutzpah, the setting, the action is astonishingly good. The last time I watched it, I was really keen for it to end about an hour before it did.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it goes on too long. It could have easily... I mean, also the thing about these days, people talk about length and like, why does it have... Like, you know, if you look at like a bunch of action films nowadays, like people... Like, I always go on like Wikipedia and, you know, people say like, you know, critics, you know, liked the performances and the action scenes, but criticized the runtime. And, you know, like... And like, why do films? Why does a film need to be 2 hours long? Like, can it be shorter? Can it be like 90 minutes? Does it like what do you? Why do you need to stretch films out that
well, some long? Films do need to be long. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia, it needs to be the length it is.
I mean, like for particular type of films, like, does it need to be 2 hours long? Do you need that little bit of that little last little quarter? Or do you think you could just can?
Yeah, you, can make you don't. A bit you don't concise? See many films that are an hour and a half anymore. That's for sure. Not in the sort of. You know, the great Hollywood tradition, like an hour and a half is like bog standard length for anything that isn't a quote-unquote epic.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, you know, that changes, of course. Like, there are you know, but there are great films from the 1930s and 40s that are an hour long. You know, Frankenstein is...
I mean, like, if you look at like some of the Marx Brothers films, they're done in like 70 minutes.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, that would be unbearable to watch that for anything more than, you know, your head would be spinning.
Yeah. Too many piano playing and harps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, see you now, bending over a hot stove, except I can't see the stove.
Nobody can outgun two-gun quail.
I feel like we've gotten ourselves off track again. But no, so I mean, that's basically where that's my verdict on Heat.
Yeah. Have you seen any other Michael Mann films?
I have. We've...
Last of the Mohicans.
There's Last of the Mohicans is a particular favourite that I think we should speak about at some point.
Yeah.
And I love Last of the Mohicans, but I'll leave that. I feel like we should do a different podcast about
it. Yeah. I've seen not all of his movies. I've seen many of his, like... I've seen bits of Manhunter, and from what I saw, I like, there were some aspects of it I quite liked. I saw The Insider, which he did with Al Pacino and Russell Crowe, which is an okay film. Again, that film, you can really feel its length. Like, it's a 2.5 hour movie, and it feels like the same length of Heat a little bit.
And it's like a courtroom.
Yeah, it's like a courtroom film. Russell Crowe plays a guy who worked for a tobacco company, and then Al Pacino plays a news guy who worked for CBS at 60 Minutes, and like them talking about like nicotine being addictive and things like that. It's a good film, but it does drag a little bit. No pun intended.
It's like big tobacco.
It's courtroom drama. Not really courtroom drama, but it's legal thriller, as they call it.
Oh, right, yeah. So I thought, for some reason, I thought Pacino was a lawyer in that film. Well, anyway, I haven't seen it, so...
It's a good film. I think it's worth checking out. I think, again, Pacino shouting in that in that as well.
But I didn't see Public Enemies.
Which is... A very, again, I think he was trying to sort of find the magic of heat in a gangster.
Well, what is the magic of heat? That's the thing.
Like, yeah, he was trying to get like you know, two big actors, Johnny Depp and Christian Bale, and yeah, the action scenes are, you know, realistic enough and everything like that. But I think what ultimately does bring that film down a little bit is that it's the way it's shot. The cinematography. I think the digital digital cinematography just kind of ruins the period, the feel of it.
Yeah, he's definitely. I mean, you get a sense from him that he considers himself something of an auteur, and yet, you know, he's not really put the stamp on modern cinema in a way.
No.
That others have, you know, I think that, you know, I do think Heat is incredibly influential, and that shouldn't be overlooked. But
yeah.
I think he probably envisioned himself being more seminal than he is, and probably, I mean, I don't know anything about the man's character, but just something in the films, there's something intentional in the films about that. They feel like they want to be monumental, whereas actually they're just big.
Yeah,
like, there's a difference between being big and being a monument.
Yeah, I mean, Colin Farrell, because he worked with him on the Miami Vice movie, and I think he was a bit mixed about his experiences with that film in regards to, like, I thought this was going to be a lot bigger than it was, than what it turned out, kind of thing, even though some people do quite like that movie. I think the film that...
I've never seen it.
Again, that is a film that's going, like, what is happening? Like, what is the storyline a little bit? Very flashy and very well made, but ultimately a little bit soulless. I think the film of his that I really like, which I consider to actually be a very good film, and I actually would say it's actually one of my top favorite films, is the Tom Cruise movie Collateral. I actually think that's a really good film.
I've never seen that film.
I think just because the script is really good. I think, I mean, it was originally written by Stuart Beatty, who was an Australian screenwriter who came to America, and originally Russell Crowe got a hold of it and wanted to star in it, but that didn't happen. But I think Frank Darabont, who wrote, who directed The Shawshank Redemption, The Green Mile, and The Mist, I think he might have did some uncredited rewrites on it and stuff like that. But whoever, you know, did the script, or Michael Mann did a little bit, I don't know. But it's a really good script, and I think just the characterization is really good. It's where I think, because he's focusing on two people in like a really small space in a taxi cab, and he's really getting a sense. There's a cat and mouse thing going on where, you know, there's like one really good scene where it builds up and boils down to where they both sort of poke holes in each of their ideologies and the way that they live and stuff.
But isn't that, I mean, I haven't seen it, but it does sound like, I mean, I'm picturing the same thing transposed onto Heat, and it just becomes a little bit unbearable afterwards. Like, okay, stop talking. Like, it's all this sort of weird cod male psychology. Like, it's...
I think it works well. I think it's a bit like Speed. Once they're out of the cab, then it sort of loses a bit of steam slightly. Like, you know, once the bus blows up, then you...
Oh, fucking hell, I haven't seen that.
Sorry.
I'm not unlikely to anyway. All right. So should we leave it there for Heat?
Yeah.
I mean, definitely recommended. Gets our seal of approval. It just, you needed some time.
Yeah.
Come on. Did you fall in love last night? You went off somewhere?
Vince.
Just tell me that. I'll settle for it. You know what I mean? I'll buy that.
Vincent.
Give me all you got!
Vincent.
Give me all you got!
I swear, my brother Richard's gonna talk to you.
Man. I heard Richard.
He'll meet you at BJ's on Alvarado at 2 a.m. Be there.
You be there too.
Vincent, I can't be there, man. I got things to do, Vince. I got things to do. I got places to be. I got to be there.
Don't waste my motherfucking time!
Yeah, birthdays and recommendations now. What
at the same time?
Well, let's do recommendations first, and then we'll move on to birthdays. What are you going to recommend me?
I recommend that you go and see Motherless Brooklyn, which I have just watched in the cinema, and it's a very fine movie. It's got its problems, of course, but it's a lovely caringly made, you know, made with a lot of care, you know, beautifully rendered vision of old New York in the 1950s. It's a great throwback. There's some lovely performances in there. You know, it's not gonna, it won't change your life, but it's a great, you know, it's a lovely little, I said lovely three times. It's a delightful, nostalgic film that feels like, it feels like the type of film that it's trying to emulate, which is great. Mm. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. Go see it, and if you can, go see it in the cinema.
Yeah, I like Edward Norton, so I definitely would like to check that out.
Yeah, he's great, actually.
Mm. Yeah, I think he directed it as well.
That's right.
Yeah. What am I going to recommend you? I'm going to recommend you a film, one of the films which I've seen fairly recently, which is the new film from the guy who directed The Witch, Robert Eggers, The Lighthouse, with Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson.
Oh, I really want to see that.
That is a fantastic film.
It looks so up my street.
I'm so happy that I got the chance to see that film, because it's actually playing in this 4-day festival that CPH Pix is doing at the moment. And I'm going to go see Jojo Rabbit tomorrow, which is part of the same festival, the Taika Waititi film.
Oh, yes,
which I've also been really excited to watch as well. I think he's a great director. But no, Rob, this movie, like, if you're a fan of, like, weird, like, you know, Moby Dick meets H.P. Lovecraft type films.
Yes, I am a fan of those things.
Then this is very much up your alley. And I read a bit of the script. It's available on a website called, I think it's called Simply Scripts, because I think it's for, like, they get all, like, the Oscar scripts, like all the ones that they try to send in for consideration and stuff. And it's on there, and it actually says in the script that it has to be shot in black and white and shot on this particular aspect ratio that makes it feel like it's a film that made in the 1930s.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Oh, gosh, that just sounds so up my street. Yeah. Can't wait.
Like, Willem Dafoe, it's interesting, because especially with those two actors, they both have two different types of acting, and I think it just works really well, and it blends really, it's so fantastic. I do have a lot of respect for directors who can, you know, can make a film with, you know, one or two actors and make it really engaging and interesting and keep it going for, you know, it's nearly a 2-hour film, but it you're just there going, like, I just want to see where this goes.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Well, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic film. One of my favorites of this year. I'm very pleased I got to see it. So, birthdays now. Top of the list, happy birthday to Lisa Bonet, who was famous for her role in The Cosby Show. She played Denise Huxtable, and she was also in Enemy of the State, directed by Tony Scott with Will Smith and Gene Hackman. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have, actually, a long time ago.
Yeah, and she's also in High Fidelity, and she also starred in...
Which I've also seen.
...in Angel Heart with Robert De Niro and Mickey Rourke.
Which I have not seen.
And her role in that film, I think, got her fired from The Cosby Show.
What does she look like?
She
looks... Oh, there we go. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel like I recognize her.
She's married to Jason Momoa.
Oh.
Yeah. Happy birthday to Missy Pyle.
Missy Pyle? That sounds like... Ugh.
She's been in a lot of, like, comedy stuff. She was in The Artist. She was in Galaxy Quest. You'll recognize her from Gone Girl. She plays that Nancy Grace newswoman.
Oh, right. Why is she second on the list?
I don't know. Happy birthday. I've been in the same room as this woman. Happy birthday to Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Oh, what were you doing in the same room as Maggie Gyllenhaal?
I went to the Berlin Film Festival, and she was on the jury there with Paul Verhoeven, and they were doing a talk together.
Oh, nice.
It was really cool. Yeah, Paul Verhoeven, he's a great director.
Well, she's a wonderful actress, Maggie Gyllenhaal.
She's great. And what's your favorite film with her?
Well, you know what? I haven't seen Secretary, but I love her in Crazy Heart, for sure. Mm. And I really like her appearance in Paris Je T'aime.
Yeah, that's a good film as well. I liked her in a film that came out last year called The Kindergarten Teacher. She was great in that film. That's a very tragic, but very good film. Happy birthday to CSI actress Marg Helgenberger, who played Catherine Willows in CSI Crime Scene Investigation, or CSI Las Vegas, if just to know which one It is.
Right, okay.
And she was in Species, Erin Brockovich, and Species 2, which was one of the films that Michael Madsen did not like working on.
Okay.
Happy birthday to Michael Irby, who is who was in the second season of True Detective, and he's recently been he's been in the TV show Mayans MC, which is the Sons of Anarchy spinoff. He plays the head of the biker group there. He's called Bishop.
Okay.
Burgess Meredith.
Oh yeah, Burgess Meredith. Yep. He's a fine actor.
Mickey and Rocky.
Yeah, he was in lots and lots of things.
And he was in Clash of the Titans from 1981.
Yeah, but I think if you go further back, I think his filmography is pretty cool. I mean, let me see. Could you mind scrolling down on this screen for me?
Yeah, sure.
That we are both looking at. What are we on now?
1977.
No. I think he's because he's really from the golden age of Hollywood. Look. Yeah. He's in one of the original adaptations of Mice and Men.
Oh, he was in.
Yeah, he's in the story of G.I. Joe. That's right. Yeah, he plays Ernie Pyle. That's right.
Isn't that the one Robert Mitchum? He got an Oscar nomination for that film.
He did. Yeah, yeah. His one and only. So yeah, no, he's been in a ton of stuff. He's one of those kind of legendary figures.
Mm. I guess he's like mostly.
Oh, yeah, no, really well, very important to point out that he's probably dead now.
Happy birthday to Pete Davidson, who is a comedian and actor from SNL.
Okay.
He was going out with Ariana Grande recently this year.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. Happy birthday to Clue Gallagher, who. I know from two horror films, two well-known horror films, Return of the Living Dead, which is a proper 80s horror film. And he's also in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, which is a very interesting film in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And, Last Picture Show, he was in that.
Oh, who's he in that?
He plays a character called Abilene.
Abilene?
Abilene.
Oh, I can't remember. Oof, I have to go back and revisit that.
Mm. And he was recently in the new Tarantino film. Happy birthday to actor Royal Dano.
Oh, he's so good. He's wonderful. He's in all the movies he's in a bunch of old westerns. He was in
The Outlaw Josie Wales.
He was in The Outlaw Josie Wales. Before that, he was in the Anthony Mann and I think most of the Anthony Mann James Stewart ones. I remember him from Bend of the River, he's really, really good in Man of the West.
Oh yeah, that's the Gary Cooper western, isn't
it? Right, exactly. Which is really, really good. And actually, did we talk about Man of the West when we did our western special?
I don't know.
Because I feel like we might have overlooked it, which would be a real serious oversight, because that is a very, very good film.
Yeah. Happy birthday to actor Miguel Sandoval, who is one of those guys you've seen him in like everything.
Oh, yeah.
He was recently in the TV show Sharp Objects. He's Ernesto, the drug dealer in Clear and Present Danger. He's also in Jurassic Park, and he's Mr. Escobar in Get Shorty.
Mr. Escobar.
He's the guy who's like, he's my sister's son. No father, not too bright. Personally, I think he's a retard. Yeah, he's been in everything.
He's in a couple of episodes of The West Wing, I think, as well, which is great.
Is he?
Yeah, he plays a lobbyist on behalf of Latinx people.
Okay. Happy birthday to James Parks, who was the son of Michael Parks. He was the Earl McGraw, the guy who played Earl McGraw in the Tarantino movies.
Okay.
And he's son number one in Kill Bill Volume 1. He's the guy that's, explaining... You know, when Michael Parks shows up at the church after the massacre, he's like, "Some number one, give me the gore details," and he's the guy explaining he's that guy. And he's appeared in quite a lot of Tarantino's movies as well, but playing different characters. He was in The Hateful Eight. He's the stagecoach driver in that film.
Oh right, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And he's appeared in a couple episodes of The Walking Dead. Oh, he's in the new season. Oh wow, that's cool. Yeah, Django Unchained, Red State, with Michael Parks as well. So, yeah, done a lot.
Cool.
Happy birthday. Oh, I'm not too familiar with this director's work, but I do want to check out some of her films because apparently they're supposed to be really good. Alison Anders, who did a film called, she was one of those like Sundance 90s filmmakers, like kind of came up with like Tarantino, and I think she was in a relationship with Tarantino, which is talked about in the Peter Biskin book Down in Dirty Pictures, which looks at like the birth of Sundance and the Weinstein brothers and Miramax and all those directors that kind of came up in that period.
And her name is literally Anders, so you really have to like her.
That I do.
Charlene Chehalis.
Who?
Who? Who? Were you a fucking owl?
The lady you've been talking dirty to on the telephone every day last week.
Yeah, all right. You know what? You can't tie me to her. Yeah,
well, who needs to? Because your ass is on a plane back to New Jersey, jagoff.
Oh, man. I just... Why'd I get mixed up with that bitch?
Because she got a great ass! And you got your head all the way up it! Ferocious, aren't I? When I think of asses, woman's ass, something comes out of me.
That's been us talking about the Michael Mann movie Heat, and you can check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Podomatic, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can also follow us on Twitter at Holmes Movies Pod. I'm also on Twitter at Fabricius91, FabriciusNine1, and also Adam is the Northampton Dane.
That's right. I'm on Instagram as well.
Yeah.
Hit me up.
Adam.h.f.holmes.
That's cool. That's about the size of it.
Yeah, you can leave us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts.
Well, you should leave us a review on iTunes.
A glowing review.
And yeah, can, 5 stars, please, nothing else.
And you can also send us an email if you would like to holmesmoviespodcast@gmail.com. We also have a blog. You can also check that out as well and read a few reviews of films on there. There's like film reviews for new releases, and also some what I usually do, like films you should watch kind of reviews.
Yeah, and I've done a few little bits and bobs there as well that have been very undiligent, so I'm just stop apologising for it now. I do that on every podcast. Okay, shall we?
Yeah, okay. Gotta go rob that bank.
Right, exactly.
What do you got? Get in the van.
But yeah, thank you very much for listening to us. I've been Anders Holmes.
Hoo-ha! Hoo-ha!
Well, that's in the cinema, it doesn't matter.
Fuck it.
Have a good day.